Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Tom Vasiliades. Did I pronounce that right?
That's right.
Good. Who is an Alexander Technique teacher in Midtown Manhattan, New York City. Tom is the chairman of the movement department at the New School for Drama, and is also on the faculty of New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, and also on the faculty of the Juilliard School. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
Tom, we're going to talk today about the question, what is the Alexander Technique? That's something we both teach. And I think a good place to start is if you could provide a short definition or description of the technique.
Well, to try to make something that's to make this as perhaps as easy as possible, for me, it's about a person using themselves and functioning better, using themselves better and functioning better. Now, that sounds a little jargony, but really what it is that we're helping people to become aware of what they're doing that's interfering with the postural mechanisms for being upright, that's interfering with breathing, that's interfering with movement, and helping them to become aware of what they're doing that's not good for them, and giving them a way of working to prevent that and transform that so that they use themselves better and function better. Now, what that means sort of concretely in everyday activities would be breathing better, making sound better, moving better, relief from chronic pain, perhaps stress reduction. So those would be benefits or byproducts of what we would call improving use and functioning.
And maybe we could add to that for people who are performers, like musicians or dancers or actors, improving the quality of their performance.
Absolutely.
Right. So yes. do you want to say a word or two about the history of the technique and how it came into being?
Well, the technique was developed by a fellow named Alexander, Frederick Matthias Alexander, who was an actor in Australia in the late 1800s. And he was on stage performing, as I understand this history, and he felt hoarseness and lost his voice. And he went to doctors and they suggested that he rest his voice, that is, don't use his voice, that would do the trick, so to speak. And he did that, then went back out on stage again and again felt hoarseness and lost his voice again. And he decided that it must be something that he's doing when he's on stage performing that's creating a loss of voice. And he set up mirrors, in fact, like a triptych of mirrors, if you ever go to a tailor and you can look in one mirror and see all around you. And he noticed that when he began to speak that he, and this is hard to maybe describe, but maybe give people listening an image of, he was shortening his neck and pulling his head back and down onto his neck, tightening in his throat, bracing in his ribs, shortening his spine, pulling his legs and arms into towards his torso. In short, he was compressing and constricting himself.
And I think it'd be useful to say that it was probably, of course, we don't know because we weren't in Australia in the late 19th century, but probably those patterns were somewhat subtle. That is, it did take him a little while, not that long, but it took him a while to actually see them.
I would say that it took him some time to notice or maybe to figure out what was going on. I mean, at least the history that I understand is he lost his voice in the fall of 1892, and was able to return to the stage in the spring of 1894. Mm-hmm. So there was something that happened in that 18-month period or so, a year and a half, that he was able to notice by looking in the mirror what it was that he was doing that he wasn't aware of. So this was an unconscious habit, if you will, that he had developed that he didn't know about, but yet he knew enough about vocal production that doing that, meaning shortening the neck, pulling the head back and down, shortening and narrowing the torso, etc., doing that and make and while you're trying to make sound will not create the sound that you want to make. Indeed, it might be such that you end up feeling hoarseless and losing your voice.
The particular challenge that he faced was he was speaking in rather large halls or auditoriums where there was no PA system.
Right.
And often these halls were filled with rowdy tin miners. And
yes.
he had to get, his interest, of course, was in projecting his voice to the back of the hall. And probably in an attempt to do that, he exaggerated some patterns of speaking and standing that he had in the rest of his life, but he tended to exaggerate them, and that's what caused his hoarseness.
That's right, and I think that happens not only for actors or, let's say, singers or people who have to, if you will, fill up a house or fill up a theater, but it also happens when there is some kind of rigorous activity that we do, that the habit becomes more pronounced, more exacerbated, but it's probably going on all the time. Mm-hmm. And what he found that he was doing this habit, and he was able to, and he wasn't yet realizing it until he saw that in the mirror. So what he would call that is a faulty sensory appreciation, meaning his ability to sense how he was moving and balancing was faulty. And one of the things that we do is to help people become aware of if there is any faulty or unreliable sensory appreciation, and to develop that so it becomes more reliable, so that we indeed reliably sense what we're doing.
Right. And, you know, you had mentioned those habits becoming more obvious when you're putting more oomph into the activity. And a great example that anyone listening could observe for themselves would be to watch people who are running or jogging. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a lot of shoulder hunching and tightening of necks. And usually when you see that, if you watch that same person just walking normally, you could very well see a little bit of that pattern there. It just gets exaggerated when they go into a more strenuous or more demanding activity.
Yes, that's right.
So what Alexander noticed about himself in the particular context of being a reciter is actually applicable to all of us in all of our everyday activities.
Indeed. Indeed. And because what he had discovered was a way of working that wasn't only helpful for breathing and making sound, but it was helpful for everything that we do, sitting, standing, walking, talking, lifting things, carrying things, all of that. And that he had figured out a way through a process of preventing that. And he used the term, as you know, inhibition or inhibiting, which is a neuromuscular term. It's not a Freudian psychological repress or suppress anything. It's a neuromuscular term in which you can say to yourself that you're not going to do something, and in this case, to not do the thing that's harmful to you, and to then direct to create or transform something that's better for you.
Right. I guess we could say that he developed a way of talking to yourself. I'll put talking in quotes because it doesn't have to be out loud, probably best if it's not out loud, but right. A way of directing yourself or telling yourself what you want or what you don't want. And it is kind of a shame that Alexander, in retrospect, that he used that word, a perfectly good word, inhibition, but he preceded Freud, and of course Freud used that term to really mean a kind of a suppression. Mm-hmm. And so the word has, in the language today, inhibition, the word has a bad press. But we're not, Alex. I think we should make it clear that Alexander Technique teachers are not about repressing stuff at all.
Right.
We're really, yeah, go ahead.
I think it's helpful, yes, to make that distinction early on, and to actually in a way to make light of it, that it's not about Freudian suppression or repression or anything like that. It's really about saying that you're not going to do something that's harmful to you in a neuromuscular sense.
And in order to know what to say no to, I think that's one place where an Alexander teacher comes into play, wouldn't you say?
Sure. I think having an Alexander teacher who has good hands-on skills, and we can talk about that in a little bit, in terms of being able to put hands on someone to help them reliably sense what it is that they're doing, and to also help them reliably prevent that or inhibit that, as we're talking about it, and to help them redirect or direct that, to transform that so they do something better in terms of
So,
their use and functioning.
right. And so people who are trained to be Alexander teachers today are basically using, I guess we could call it a process, a teaching process that Alexander developed over the years. Maybe it would be useful for you to describe that process in terms of it involving both verbal instructions, but also hands-on work. And maybe it would be good if you said a bit about how we use our hands to help students.
Yeah. Well, one, it's certainly when you were saying earlier about we are sort of talking to ourselves, it's like we're having a conversation with ourselves in terms of inhibiting and directing. And I think that's what goes on in a lesson. You're having a conversation, or I'm having a conversation, you are having a conversation with a student that includes some kind of perhaps verbal instruction, verbal suggestions, and also some hands-on work to guide the student to become aware of what it is that they're doing, to help them in this process of inhibiting and directing. So, for example, at least how I think of it is in putting my hands on a student, I while I'm doing that, I'm not simply mindlessly, if you will, putting hands on a student. As I'm putting hands on a student, I am also looking at or sensing reliably, hopefully, sensing what it is that is going on with me as I'm putting hands on a student. And in doing so, I can better sense what is happening with that student. Again, is that student creating something that I would call a compression, some kind of compression or constriction?
And that ability to put your hands on a person and sense that sense compression or tightening or stiffening is something that, for most of us anyway, takes a fair amount of training to get to that point.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there is where I trained in New York City at the American Center for the Alexander Technique about 17 years ago now, and it still is a 3-year program that spans 1,600 hours.
And that's pretty typical of Alexander Technique teacher training programs, we should say. It tends to be 3 years and around 1,600 hours.
Yes.
A fairly intense process for anyone who's gone through it. So, of course, one of the things that you have to learn is what you just described, the ability to sense what a student is doing, but also the ability to direct them or to guide them perhaps into a different way of being. You want to say something about that?
Yes, and what and the guiding, I mean, I agree with you, guiding, and what I'm thinking about it, that might in some case, what someone might infer from that is that we are doing something to someone, or something to someone, whereas the student has to be an active participant. And what I mean by that is that the student is with their inhibiting and directing process. So they are having that conversation with themselves in terms of not shortening the neck, not pulling the head back and down, not shortening the back and narrowing the back, et cetera. And they're giving themselves a direction for this lengthening and widening to occur. And as they're working, as they're directing themselves and going with this process of inhibiting and directing, it's then that a teacher might be able to, with their hands, help guide them to have even more of this uprightness, more of this openness, more of this expansiveness that the student might at the moment not be able to do for herself or himself.
Right. I guess you could say that we as teachers can facilitate and maybe speed up the learning process. Would that be a fair way to describe it?
We take the learning process in a particular direction, to be sure. We are able to help them become aware of things that they might not otherwise become aware of, or it might take them longer to become aware of. Mm-hmm. We might help them to develop the skill of inhibiting and directing, because they will have our feedback that in terms of, oh no, you think you're directing, but you're actually trying to muscle yourself to be taller, to be longer, to be freer. And so we can, with our hands on, can really help them to understand that kinesthetically for themselves.
So maybe it would be useful to just very briefly cover the rest of Alexander's life. We kind of left him in Australia, but he did move to London in 1904, and had some connections with the U.S. He traveled to New York and to Boston a fair amount in the teens and in the 20s. Do you want to just kind of follow up on the rest of his teaching and training career?
He did come to the States in the teens, also in the 20s. Indeed, he even came to the States during the Second World War.
That's right, he did, yeah.
And so he moved to London in 1904, and he died in 1955. He also had a number of influential people who were interested in his work. One is an American philosopher, John Dewey, fairly well known in philosophical circles and education as well. Aldous Huxley, Sir Stafford Cribbs, and there were a number of people who were quite interested in him creating some kind of a formal training over the years. Certainly, when he went to London, and then he came to the States, there were people like these names might not mean anything to listeners, but you would know them, Ethel Webb and Irene Tasker.
Right. He had assistants that he trained on a pretty informal basis.
Right, right. And then it was in the 1930s, in the early 30s, when he began to formally train people. There are a number of people from that first that first decade of training that continued on to then start their own trainings after Alexander died, and sort of the legacy continues.
Right, and today there are probably at least 3,000 or 4,000 Alexander teachers around the world.
Yes, I've heard about 4,000 is the number.
Something in that range, yeah. Yes. And there are a great many training courses. You mentioned the one that you went on attended in New York City. I trained on a training course in London many years ago. But there are training courses around the world at this point.
Sure. I also teach currently. I teach at a training program here in New York, ATNYC, which is run by John Nichols and Annette Walsh.
Right. So yeah. there are a lot of training courses out there. What I think might be kind of interesting for someone listening to this who would be to address the question of, let's say I do decide I want to take an Alexander lesson and check this out. What might someone expect to happen when they show up for their first lesson?
If I could just add one thing before I get to that question,
sure.
'Cause in terms of finishing up what we were just talking about, because we were talking about sensory appreciation,
right.
And if it's faulty or reliable, we were talking about inhibiting and directing.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that Alexander discovered was that there is a relativity of the relationship between the head, neck, back, and the legs and arms. And the reason I want to put that in there, because I think it's a key piece to the Alexander work, that we are a totality, we are a whole, a unity. There's all sorts of ways, phrases and terms to talk about this, so that there is this organization of the head, neck, torso, legs, and arms, that when that's going well, we are using ourselves well and functioning well. When that organization is not going well, we're not using ourselves well and functioning well. So for me, to sort of round this out in terms of what the Alexander technique is to me, is sensory appreciation, is to help somebody develop a more reliable sensory appreciation in terms of movement and balance, to have a lengthening stature instead of a shortening stature. And the process is this inhibiting and directing process that you and I have been speaking about, and that there is this looking at ourselves as a whole, so we're not the head plus the neck plus the torso plus the legs plus the arms, that there's us, and we have a head, neck, torso, legs, and arms, and it's organized in some way. That's what we're looking at. And I think that's what, now going into your question, a student, when they come to me, I will say there are three things that we're going to be working on. Sensory appreciation, for you to discover if your sensory appreciation is faulty or reliable, and to help it become more reliable. You're going to develop this process of inhibiting and directing, and to become more skillful with that, and that to relate to yourself as a whole, as a totality. So that there is this relationship of the head, neck, torso, legs, and arms, and you want to notice yourself, meaning you want to be able to sense yourself as a whole, as a totality, and that what you're doing is not creating a shortening of the stature, but rather is creating a lengthening of the stature.
That, and another way of maybe paraphrasing that last statement is that a lot of us act like we want to take up as little room as we can in some way. We tend to scrunch ourselves in one way or another. And
sure.
And of course, that interferes with all sorts of things, breathing and movement and all the rest. And that Alexander lessons are a way to undo that, to learn to undo that squeezing, let's call it, or tightening. And
yes,
and
yes.
The point you made at the beginning of the three things, the unreliable sensory appreciation, sometimes people are a little surprised at that. I think most people assume that what they feel about themselves is an accurate indication of what's going on.
Right.
And unfortunately, it often isn't. And an example that I would give new students a lot is pretty much everybody knows somebody who has a very odd way of standing or walking, perhaps pulling to one side or leaning very far forward or arching their back excessively.
Mm-hmm.
And chances are that that person is not conscious of those patterns, and they might be kind of surprised to learn about them.
Yes.
And for example, a person that tends to pull a little to one side all the time, if they were to go to an Alexander teacher and the teacher were to help them to release that, they're going to feel now as though they're leaning in the opposite direction when actually they're standing relatively straight, let's say.
Yes.
And I think that's a very simple example to illustrate this idea of faulty sensory awareness. And one thing that an Alexander teacher can do very quickly and easily, if someone is distorting themselves in a fairly obvious way like that is to get them looking at themselves in a mirror, perhaps a side view or a front view, and they can see that what they feel is going on doesn't necessarily match what's actually going on.
Sure. How that will happen sometimes in a lesson is, let's say I will have somebody profile to the mirror, and I'll be working with them, going from sitting to standing and standing to sitting, and doing that work, and then they'll begin to feel, let's say that they're, in this case, they feel like they're way back, they're really on their heels, they're way back, and they'll have that experience. And what's interesting is that it's not simply having that experience, because to be sure that they're having that experience, it's that there is excessive muscular tension going on for what they are actually doing. So that they feel like they're pitched back, but yet they're actually not back at all. But because they feel that way, there is excessive and unnecessary tension that's creating a shortening of the stature and a misuse. And so it's getting them to see what they are actually doing, that they can actually let that go, and that they see, oh, what's possible. They see a new thing that's possible. But you, in some ways, certainly early on, people have to have that experience of what they think they're not doing what they sense that they're doing. And that can be quite shocking to them.
And humbling, I
Yes,
think for some
indeed.
people it is a real shock. I often quote there's a cartoon that doesn't exist anymore, but a Pogo, which was back in the 60s, and there's a perfect line that Pogo says at one point, which is, "We have met the enemy, and they is us."
That's right.
And that is really exactly the situation we're all in, really, in terms of
Yes.
our use, our the way we use ourselves, the way we function, that we're basing our actions, or we're basing what we decide to do or how we decide to do it on what we're feeling. And for a few people out there, their feelings may be very reliable. I think Fred Astaire probably had extremely reliable sensory appreciation, but for most of us, it's gotten distorted by various, well, the stresses of life or whatever,
Yes, the
and
slings and arrows,
the
exactly.
slings and arrows, right? And so we're in this situation where we're directing ourselves, but we're directing ourselves with faulty information.
Yes.
And really, that's one way, I guess, of describing what the technique is about, is to learn to sense things as they are, and then take appropriate action, if you like, or appropriate thinking to change those patterns. Does that sound reasonable to you as a kind of a short description of
Yes,
the technique?
yes. And the actions or the measures that people take is one in which you prevent yourself from doing the thing that you do that isn't good for you. That's part of
That's
it.
it, yes. And
And
I think we should say that idea of not doing the things that get in the way is something that really distinguishes the Alexander technique from, as far as I know, pretty much every other method of physical, let's say, or somatic self-improvement. I mean, the usual approach to I have a physical problem is do some new thing, perhaps an exercise or whatever it is, and the Alexander approach is, why not find out what you are doing that's causing a problem and just stop doing that? Which sounds incredibly easy and logical, and almost anyone, when you say that to them, will say, sure, that makes sense. But to actually learn to do that, while it's in some ways very simple, it's not always that easy at first.
Yes, it's very challenging. It deals with the preconceived ideas that a person has. and they might be unconscious preconceived ideas, but nonetheless about how they should be, what they should be doing, and so on. And to say to someone, well, I'd like you to not do that, to not do what you've been doing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, is quite challenging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when we're teaching someone, we have to create a very safe environment where it's absolutely okay to make, quote, mistakes, unquote.
Yes, we're not, yes.
And I guess to be a good Alexander teacher, you have to learn to be kind of non-judgmental in the sense of good, bad kind of judgments. You
exactly.
Know, yeah, go ahead.
As important as developing good hands-on skills and understanding these, if you will, principles or concepts of the Alexander work, there is also, I think, an art to teaching, mm-hmm. in which it's a creative process that you're doing with an individual, mm-hmm. and everyone is different. And that, if you will, that teacher-student relationship that gets created is an art. I think of it as a creative activity. It's an artistic activity, and you have to develop that. And that's as much a skill in teaching as can you put hands on can a teacher put hands on a person without the teacher constricting herself or himself?
Right. Because if the teacher does constrict himself or herself, that gets conveyed right to the student, who will constrict in response to that.
Yes.
And it's interesting that that term, the art of teaching, because actually I believe Alexander used that very phrase in one of his books. And he says somewhere that different teachers are, he basically says different teachers are going to teach differently. And the important thing is certain key principles that they need to bring into the teaching. But he fully understood that teachers are human beings. We're all different, and we all have different approaches to the teaching process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I guess one thing that would be a useful bit of information for someone who's contemplating taking lessons would be how would you choose a teacher? Let's say you're fortunate enough to live in a place like New York City where there are lots of teachers. What would you suggest as a strategy, apart from finding someone who's relatively near you or easy to mm-hmm. get to,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps recommendations of somebody, but just as a strategy for evaluating, if you come for a lesson or two, how would you judge whether a particular teacher is going to be good for you?
Well, I think you need one. I would suggest to try a number of teachers to see if there's any difference between teachers.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way you can do that.
That's assuming, of course, that you have that luxury. I mean, where I live, you basically mm-hmm. try me.
Right. Yeah, well, good for you, I guess.
Yeah, well,
your
yes
practice.
And no. I mean, it's actually pretty nice to have other teachers around.
Yeah.
But, and so don't hesitate to have lessons with more than one teacher. And what, to start with anyway, and how would you suggest someone evaluate whether – apart from whether the chemistry is okay with that person, how would you evaluate whether they're actually helping you or not?
Well, I think that's a difficult question to answer, because it depends on what they're there for, and if the particular teacher who is teaching this person. What is it that they're doing? Again, for me, and what we've been discussing in terms of is the teacher helping this student become aware of what they're doing? Is this teacher working with this principle of inhibition and direction, getting the student to not only become aware of what they're doing, but getting them to not do that and to direct, to transform that? I think it really... it's a hard question to answer. I think generally you could say is if the student is experiencing a kind of freedom and openness and becoming aware of how they're doing things and developing some kind of skill to prevent themselves from doing the things that aren't good for them and to transform that to do things that are better for them. That's a very vague statement, but somewhere in that, that's what a student needs to be looking at.
Mm-hmm. And how many lessons do you think it would take someone to get to the point where they could say for sure that this is a process they want to continue?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think it obviously depends on the student and what's going on, because it's as I said earlier, it's not only on the teacher. It's also on the student,
mm-hmm.
because the student is an active participant, and the student would have to be honest with herself or himself to say, well, am I being open to what this teacher is presenting me? So, for example, if someone comes to see me and they're very rigid, very held, and we start doing some work in the chair or on the table, and I am suggesting to them to, you know, maybe undo the rigidity, not hold or brace, and they continue to do so, then it's something to question. Oh, are they committed to not doing something, or are they simply having difficulty, and over time they will get better at this activity of
right.
doing less? So right. it's a very hard question. I do say, with all that said, I do believe that someone who comes to see me taking 15 to 20 lessons, 25 lessons, will get a basic understanding of the Alexander work.
Mm-hmm. And I also tell people that if they are going to explore the technique, they probably should give it at least 3 or 4 lessons before deciding whether they want to continue past that. Because
absolutely.
A lot of people, I mean, it's so variable. A lot of people will notice the changes almost instantly. I mean, a lot of people will immediately get that this is a useful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But some people may not right away. It might just take a little bit longer. For whatever reason, they may not actually sense the changes, or they might sense them kind of indirectly. In my own case, which I think is a little probably not that typical,
mm-hmm.
I went for lessons based on reading about a particular teacher. And I have to say, I didn't notice anything in lessons for quite a while. However, I also noticed that I had gained almost an inch in height,
mm-hmm.
and my clothes didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I could only attribute that to Alexander. And so
right.
I knew good stuff was going on, but I didn't actually feel anything much. I think that my own feeling sense of myself was pretty restricted at that point. And in fact, I hate to admit it, but it wasn't until about halfway through my Alexander Technique training course that I actually felt something happen during a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an extreme. I meet very few people like that in my own teaching. I'm always amazed at how quickly people do sense changes.
Mm-hmm.
But be open to the possibility, I guess we could say, that you might not feel it directly, or it might be that somebody else will notice something about you.
Right.
Before you notice it.
Right.
That happens sometimes.
How come you continue to take lessons when you weren't feeling?
Because I knew that good things were going on.
Mm-hmm.
I had to buy new clothes.
Uh-huh.
I was working, I had a pretty straight job then. I was working for the Ontario government as an economist, and I had to wear jackets and ties sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And none of the jackets fit anymore, and my pants were all too short. So I knew that stuff was happening, and people
right.
around me commented on it. So when I was taking lessons initially, it never occurred to me, actually, that I should feel anything during a lesson, which is
right.
which is strange looking back on it, because pretty much everyone I teach now does notice something, certainly within the first couple of lessons. But there are people like me out there, who like the me that used to be, who just aren't that sensitive at first. And it doesn't mean that you're not going to benefit from the lessons. It may mean you're not going to get those nice physical sensations right away that other people do.
Right. And it's interesting that you're saying that, because there are a number of students over the years who have been somewhat similar, that they've been taking lessons for a few years, and I might even be sensing something going on with them. Other people notice something about them. That, oh, you look taller, you look bigger, you look less tense or less constricted. But they're not experiencing that, and yet they continue to come back, because on some level it seems to me that they are understanding that something is happening.
Right. And you know, an interesting way that I tend to work a lot with groups, and if you have, like, say 15 or 20 people sitting in a large circle, and you go around and help everyone release, say, a little neck and shoulder tension, and you ask everyone to be watching also, it's amazing that some people will make really big changes instantly,
mm-hmm.
and may not notice it at all, but everyone else in the room notices it.
Yes.
And some people, even a teacher might not be sure there much has changed,
mm-hmm.
but they report huge amount of release.
Yes.
That the teacher may not see or even sense, and that most people in the room wouldn't see. And it's just a perfect illustration of the fact that what you sense is going on may not be accurate, or you may feel that nothing's happening when a lot is happening. There's not always a direct line between what you feel and what's actually going on. It kind of goes back to that initial kinesthetic awareness thing that we were talking about earlier.
Sure, indeed.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to say about the technique or Alexander technique teaching, bearing in mind that we're talking to an audience of people who probably have not had any direct experience with the work?
Yeah, I would say two things. One is, you were asking me earlier about what people come for a lesson with me, what would they do? And in the individual lessons that I do, I do a lot of what we call chair work, of getting in and out of the chair. Mm-hmm. And what that is about, because actually people, I was thinking about what people might find, how come we're doing this? How come we're going in and out of the chair and all of that stuff? Going back to what I was saying earlier about that relationship of the head, neck, back, legs, and arms, that when we fold and unfold the legs, we put a demand on the organization of the head, neck, and back. So when people are folding the legs to go into the chair or into picking something up from the floor, that there is a demand that goes on the back and the head and neck. And how do people respond to that? Do they do that by shortening the spine? Do they do that by shortening and narrowing the back? And it's a way in which I feel that developing that organization for upright posture is very key to the Alexander work. I think that that's what Alexander was. That's how come Alexander, until he died, was doing work in the chair. I don't think that it was about he didn't want to do other activities or all activities are the same. I think there's something very powerful on a fundamental way of doing work in a chair. So I will do some work in a chair. Then with somebody, I'll have them lie on the table and do what we call the lying down work. And then maybe do a little bit more chair work. That's what I would do. That's what I do mostly in my individual lessons. And in group classes, I give group classes to all sorts of to the general public. I sometimes do group classes to a specific group of performers or people with chronic pain, different kinds of group classes. And what I do is I have, let's say, a series of 10 or 15 classes that meet once a week. And within that 10 or 15 week period, I'll offer maybe 5 or 7 30-minute individual lessons outside of class time, because I find that, what I found at least, that doing solely group classes is, for me, is not as effective as getting some concentrated hands-on time with someone to be able to deal with their unique situation.
Right. Well, yeah, the whole topic of group work is a mildly controversial one in the Alexander world. There's some people who don't believe their technique should be taught in groups at all. Mm-hmm. But just to get back to chair work and table work, the idea of using the act of standing up and sitting down as a framework within which to explore and work on certain patterns of movement, the idea there is that it will carry over into other things. So we're not really about teaching people how to stand and sit.
We're teaching them
how to do everything. But that's a very common activity, and it's one that does require a fair amount of muscular coordination to carry off. I mean, I think Alexander was very wise to settle on that as a primary teaching procedure. And maybe I want to just say a word or two about table work, which typically you're lying on a massage table or a fairly firm surface, and there's either your feet are on the ground or there's some way to get your knees up higher than your hips, and there's often a support under your head. And the idea there is that that's a position that tends to take as much compression off your spine as is possible in a gravitational field, and it frees you from having either completely or to a very large extent having to deal with gravity. I mean, there's really nothing much for you to do physically when you're lying down. So it's a way of, and in that context, it's often possible to get, help people get a bit more release of harmful habits than you could if they were standing or sitting. And then of course the trick is to carry that over into activity. I just wanted to clarify those two. Those are two very basic Alexander technique teaching procedures that were developed by Alexander himself and are still used today.
Yes, yes. And also that with the lying down work, maybe another way of saying it is that we don't have the demand of being upright and we don't have the demand of movement. So it's this terrific opportunity to let go of or give up those habits of compression and constriction, because there is no demand.
And there's no danger.
There's nowhere
you can fall, or, you know, you could let go of something and you're not going to topple over.
Right. And the books under their head allow for a length of the spine and a stretch and a spread on the back, again, without doing anything. And you continue that inhibiting and directing process that's going on at the table when you come up to standing and doing some work in the chair, and then you take that into your daily life and doing all the things that you do.
And I guess another thing to be said about table work is that shows you a position basically that you can use on your own to get some release. It's excellent homework for students to spend.
If they can do that twice a day, 10, 15 minutes each time,
it'll make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
A huge difference. And I think we've kind of presented a pretty good overview of the technique. What do you think?
I think so. This is great, Robert.
And my guest today has been Tom Vasiliotes.
Vasiliotes,
sorry. Yes. Who is an Alexander Technique teacher in Midtown Manhattan. He's chair of the movement department at the New School for Drama and is on the faculty of New York University's Tisch School of the Arts and also of the Juilliard School. Tom, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Great. Thanks for having me, Robert.